From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, Dr. Vartan Gregorian discusses his new autobiography.
Gustave Flaubert once remarked, giving the public details about one's life is a bourgeois temptation that I've always resisted. For a long time, I sympathized with his position. However, when one's relatives, teachers, professors, and friends die and keep dying, one has an obligation, I believe, indeed one is compelled to be a witness, to write about them in order to preserve their memory.
The Road to Home, My Life and Times by Vartan Gregorian, tonight on Boston University's World of Ideas. First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Four U.S. soldiers and a journalist were wounded in two attacks in Iraq today, and another U.S. soldier died of heat stroke. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Richard Lugar says President Bush's advisors have made erroneous assumptions about post-war Iraq.
The basic assumptions, whoever was making them, at State, at NSC, at Defense, simply were inadequate to begin with. Now, having said that, I would reiterate, we're there now. Whether they made a good choice or not in terms of tactics is irrelevant.
Lugar told NBC the administration needs to inform Iraqis about U.S. goals for that country. Israeli warplanes bombed suspected Hezbollah positions in southern Lebanon today. That attack came hours after Hezbollah guerrillas shelled a village in northern Israel, killing a 16-year-old boy and wounding five other people, including an infant. NPR's Kate Seeley reports from Beirut.
Lebanese officials said Israeli warplanes attacked at least one Hezbollah anti-aircraft position in southwest Lebanon. The attack was in response to the shelling of the northern Israeli town of Shlomi today. Hezbollah said its anti-aircraft shells were directed at Israeli fighter jets flying over southern Lebanon. The Islamist group routinely fires at Israeli overflights, but there have been no serious casualties in the past. An Israeli government spokesman called the Hezbollah attack a clear provocation and said Israel would not sit idly by. Today's flare-up follows an upsurge of violence along the Israel-Lebanon border. On Friday, Hezbollah guerrillas attacked Israeli army posts in the disputed Shabbat Farms area. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Beirut.
Liberia's President Charles Taylor has delivered a farewell address on the eve of his expected resignation. Taylor said he is being forced into exile. NPR's Jason Bobien has more from Monrovia.
In his farewell address, President Taylor lashed out at the United States. He accused the United States of funding the lured rebels who are currently besieging Monrovia. He said, quote, this is an American war against Liberia. He said that the U.S. has been training lured rebels across the northern border in Guinea. He also compared himself to Jesus Christ, who died for his people. And he said that he's the sacrificial lamb. He called himself the whipping boy, and he's sacrificing himself for peace in Liberia, he said.
NPR's Jason Bobien in Monrovia. The man considered the greatest tap dancer of his generation, Gregory Hines, has died in Los Angeles at the age of 57. Hines had a flowing dance style that was reminiscent of Fred Astaire. In 1997, he showed off his talent at Ford's Theater in Washington.
Some good.
Gregory Hines added acting to his repertoire. He had starring roles in films such as White Nights and Cotton Club, and in 1992, he won a Tony Award for the musical Jelly's Last Jam. This is NPR News from Washington.
Good evening in Boston. I'm Gina Tempesta. A helicopter pilot and firefighters saved seven people from Massachusetts and Rhode Island today. All seven were pulled from the water in three dramatic rescues on Maine rivers, which were swollen and raging from torrential rains. Meanwhile, up to 5 inches of rain in 3 hours today washed out a road in Westmoreland, New Hampshire, for the second time in 5 days. The section of Route 12 was just about 75% repaired from the washout earlier on Wednesday. Officials are investigating the death of a Falmouth man found in Wild Harbor today. A Coast Guard spokesman says that the 64-year-old man was last seen last night leaving a party at his home. The man's name has not been released, pending notification of family. And a group of clergy sexual abuse survivors and supporters is challenging the Boston Archdiocese to reevaluate its $55 million settlement to victims of sexual abuse. Members held a press conference today to say the settlement for 540 alleged victims does not begin to cover the victims' out-of-pocket expenses. In the forecast tonight, showers likely, still a chance of a thunderstorm with lows in the low 70s. Tomorrow, showers and thunderstorms likely through the afternoon with highs in the low 80s. Right now, it's 77 in Boston.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. MathWorks.com. By Goldsmiths 3, presenting a diverse selection of handcrafted wedding and engagement rings featuring ideal cut Lazar diamonds 12 miles west of Cambridge in Concord Center and at goldsmiths3.com. And by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children on the web at aecf.org.
Welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight, we bring you a lecture by Dr. Vartan Gregorian, president of Carnegie Corporation of New York. Speaking at the School of Management Auditorium, Dr. Gregorian discussed his new autobiography, The Road to Home, My Life and Times. Introducing Dr. Gregorian is Boston University Chancellor John Silver.
From the applause, I judge that Mr. Gregorian needs no introduction, but that's what I'm supposed to do, so... Stay with me just a second. This remarkable man came to my attention back in about 1968 when I served on the Harbison Committee for the selection of Harbison Award winners for excellence in teaching. And of about 200 resumes that we reviewed, his was by far the most outstanding. A truly remarkable man, and what the students said about him was... almost unbelievable unless you really understood just how great some teachers can be, and he was one of those. So we selected him as one of the winners, and then at that time I was Dean of Arts and Sciences at the University of Texas and took advantage of that occasion to recruit him to Texas. This was, a conflict of interest on my part, but it certainly was a great benefit to the University of Texas and to all the students with whom he came in contact. There was no stopping Vartan Gregorian. He moved from Texas, as most of you know, to Pennsylvania, from Pennsylvania to the New York Public Library, where he absolutely transformed and actually saved that great institution, and then to Brown University, and then back to the Carnegie Corporation as president. But none of this really reflects the remarkable quality of this man. He did have the good fortune to have a truly remarkable maternal grandmother who not only reared him, but who also supplied him with aphorisms that she had never told him about, but made available to him in the 60 or 70 years after he separated from her, which he can use on any occasion. It doesn't matter what the occasion is, Vartan can find a quotation from his grandmother. I recall that after I got fired at the University of Texas, I went to a faculty meeting, and it was very acrimonious. And some professor got up and said, you know, he who lives by the sword shall die by the sword, meaning me, because I'd fired a few people in the process of being dean. And Vartan gets up and he says, as my Armenian grandmother told me, when the cow falls, the butchers gather. it was not just this occasion. It was almost any occasion. If there was a crisis at hand, Vartan could defuse it by remembering one of the things his grandmother had never said to him. I was asked, when Vartan left Texas, I had already come to Boston University. When he left Texas, I was asked to comment about him, and I thought I would end my introduction with that comment. I can't improve upon it, I wrote this when I was still young and had the ability to say such nice things. Vartan Gregorian is one of the most imaginative and learned men I know. Although he is a superb teacher and renowned historian, his most revealing quality is his unpredictable and compelling sense of humor, a magic carpet that carries his ideas and purposes to fruition with remarkable frequency and minimal opposition. He has the innocence of a baby, the integrity and dedication of a saint, and the political skills of a Talleyrand. A marvel of energy, wit, determination, winsome laughter, and high idealism. I don't think you can find a finer man.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, John. As you know, those of you who read the book, you know that John Silver and I go back almost 35 years. He and his family has been great friends of ours, and we're indebted to him, not only because he gave me my first university job, but the fact that we have had such tremendously creative and close friendship. We've not agreed always, but we've always loved each other. And you saw the example. You even made fun of my grandmother and me. Gustave Flaubert once remarked, "Giving the public details about one's life is a bourgeois temptation that I've always resisted." For a long time, I sympathized with his position. However, when one's relatives, teachers, professors, and friends die and keep dying, one has an obligation, I believe, indeed one is compelled to be a witness, to write about them in order to preserve their memory. In 1999, I was separated from my left kidney. While at the hospital, I had to face my own mortality. While making a mental inventory of my life, I confronted the fact that while I was very sociable, while many knew about my public persona, only a handful of individuals knew the private Vartan Gregorian. This was not by accident. It was by design. Throughout my entire adult life, I have cherished and protected my privacy, the privacy of my family, and the privacy of my friends. Lying in the hospital bed, I realized that I had not discussed various facets and intimate episodes of my youth, development, and career with my wonderful sons. I wanted them to know about my grandmother who raised me, my sister, my father, and my stepmother, and my background and upbringing. My grandmother is one of the central characters of my book. She had seven children and lost all of them. My sister and I remained her only offspring. Her dedication, care, and love for us were boundless. As a child, I was allergic to all kinds of authority except hers. She tamed me through her devotion and love. Her dignity, her comportment, her stoicism astonished me. Her hard life, her admonitions and moral instructions taught me a cardinal lesson. Anybody can cope with success, but it's how one deals with adversity, failure, and tragedy that reveal one's true character. Last year, when I received a fundraising appeal from Landmine Survivors Network, it was accompanied by a poem entitled "Refuse," written by Clarissa Pinkola Estes, a person I had never heard of. It read, "Refuse to fall down. And if you cannot refuse to fall down, then refuse to stay down. And if you cannot refuse to stay down, then lift your heart to the heavens like a hungry beggar and ask that it be filled, and it will be filled." I was stunned. These were my grandmother's very sentiments. They were being reaffirmed by an author of Spanish and Mexican ancestry who was adopted by Hungarian immigrants in the United States. It was an extraordinary coincidence. It gave me an eerie feeling. One of my grandmother's legacies to us was her firm belief that one good name, honor, and character were not negotiable. They were not commodities to be traded. We were told that one should accept criticism of one's opinions, one's looks, one's actions, one's judgment, but we had to resist and reject vigorously personal insults and acts of humiliation. This injunction of hers was easy to comprehend. The difficult one was her subsequent advice, after rejecting insults and attempts to humiliate you, You must not allow feelings of anger and revenge dominate you, for they will only corrode your inner life. One has to put aside the hurt for one's own sanity. One has to forgive the transgressor while rejecting the transgression. Otherwise, the transgressor would win by making the insults and humiliation as permanent features of one's psyche and memory. Of all the injunctions and advice, I found this one the hardest to practice. On several occasions when insulted and humiliated, indeed in one instance I said, I'm not a Mr. Magoo, when somebody spits at me, I cannot pretend that it's a raindrop. I could not reconcile acts of forgiving and forgetting. It took me a long time to understand the soundness of her advice. My maternal grandmother was an extraordinary person. She was an illiterate peasant woman. She was a church-going, fervent Christian. My grandmother seemed dazed by the calamities visited upon her, by the loss of her husband, loss of six of her seven children, and the seventh died shortly afterwards, loss of her home and village, loss of her grandson. I had the impression, and I grew up, that she was angry at God or mystified by his actions, and that she lived to protest against him. Her rudimentary argument with God was that since he is the author, or at least it's with his consent that events take place in the world, he could have preserved at least some of her children, since she was now sinful to deserve such a severe punishment. Her grief was private. She never complained. She cried for her sorrow. She cried for her children only in private. Her plight broke my heart. Since my grandmother did not know how to read, she had no access to the Bible. She knew only a couple of short prayers by heart. And occasionally she would come back from church and say, the priest gave a sermon. I said, what did he say? I didn't understand a word of it, but you should have heard him. Thanks to my grandmother, I was acquainted with a world full of mythology, magic, and fantasy, where everything was simple, meaningful, and even beautiful. Since she could not read books to me and my sister, she spun tales. I learned that the stars were human souls living in the sky, and each of us could choose our exclusive star. Naturally, I chose the North Star as mine. These stars were our guardians. They not only protected us, but had us under constant watch to see that we did the right thing. They were gifts of God given to each of us upon our birth. They served as lamps to light our inner world, enabling us to see its richness. They were seats of our conscience. They gave us a sense of goodness, love, compassion, tolerance, and justice. The soul lived in the heart in an indefinite shape as a body of light. The soul was also conceived to be air or breath. It was believed that when somebody died, the soul left the body through the mouth. The individual expired like a candle. The moon and the sun were brother and sister, she told us. The sun was a very beautiful girl, but she was modest also. Since she was naked, she was ashamed to appear before human beings who did not respect her privacy and stared at her constantly. She cried for many long hours. Then one day, God, pitying her, gave her needles to help her protect herself. It's since that day that we cannot look at the sun. She would not only blush, but would also send needles into our eyes to avert our gaze. Her brother, the moon, on the other hand, was a nasty and naughty boy who constantly annoyed his sister. One day, their mother, the heaven, who was knitting bread, could not take it anymore. She slapped him with a handful of flour. The white spots that we see on the face of the moon are the consequences of that punishment. From that time on, it has been impossible to see the moon and sun together. The moon is chasing his sister to punish her for having reproached him before their mother. It is, however, a futile effort. He is running after her, but to this day has not been able to catch her. My grandmother was, as you can see, a wonderful storyteller. There were moralistic tales to teach children, her grandchildren, and youth about virtue, duty, and wisdom. The tales usually dealt with light and darkness, evil and good, selfish villains and generous souls, angels and demons, gardens, waterfalls, water fountains, treasures, cunning, greed, flattery, avarice, wicked stepmothers, actions that appeared or outwitted evil and relied on or prayed to God. Human beings or animals who talked, married, had offspring, and had magical ability and imparted wisdom. My grandmother was also a disciplinarian. It was not all just preaching. Grandmother taught us morality and ethics through stories, fables, and allegories. Indeed, the entire Middle East, where I went to school, instead of preaching, they always used fables, tales, and therefore as an indirect way of trying to teach you didactic lesson. She started with the basics. You must not lie because you will lose all your credibility. Do good, but don't expect reciprocity or even gratitude. Life has its own logic, its own cycles. Sooner or later, you will be the object of good deeds, their beneficiary. Since life resembles to a wheel of fortune, don't step on those who are down. Give a helping hand, she would say. For those who are on the bottom will come up to the top one day, and those who are on the top will go to the bottom one day. Therefore, one must not judge people by their current stations in life. People's circumstances may change throughout life, but who they are will not. My grandmother admonished me about the seven deadly sins when I was 12. I don't think she knew the number, but at least that's the number she told us. I understood about pride, anger, and sloth. I had no notion of covetousness, lust, or gluttony. Envy, however, impressed me most because I was told it was a bottomless pit. Certain virtues were hard to understand until later in life, such as humility, generosity, restraint, moderation, forgiveness, and charity. Her bottomless stories or sayings were to help guide us through life. These are some of those that have stayed with me throughout the years. The stomach is an oven. If there is adequate fuel in it, don't overburden it. You don't build a reputation or make a name for yourself on what you are going to do. An unkind word is like a thrown stone. It cannot be called back. The reason you have a house with walls is to keep the family news inside. Don't make a private matter public one. This is one of the hardest things for me was to write my autobiography. It's precisely that, discussing family business publicly. Don't insult a crocodile before you cross a river. Those who know much don't talk too much. And good advice, like good medicine, is hard to swallow. My grandmother instilled in me, in the early age, the notions of reputation, honor, and dignity. I learned from her and at school as well how to distinguish between chakatagir, which means fate, kismet, or what is written on your forehead, and nikaragir, which means character, or what is imprinted in you. Over the first, I was told, we had no control, but in the case of nikaragir, or character, we're fully responsible and accountable. She taught us not to envy, because envy tends to deform character. You must not have a hole in your eye, she used to say. That hole is bottomless. It can never be filled. Human envy is insatiable and will diminish an individual. Instead of envying individuals for what material possessions they have, high positions they hold, or power they wield, one must be impressed only by who they are, respect them for values they possess, and what good they do. The teaching and musings of my grandmother, I soon discovered, were not original. When I went to school, the same things were taught at school. Indeed, as a choir boy and altar boy, I heard some of them during the Sunday sermons as well as at school. What was unique about my grandmother, however, was that she practiced what she taught. Another major theme of my autobiography is about kindness of strangers. My editor and I, Alice Mayhew, had big arguments about the title of this book. I wanted the book to be known, or to be called, With the Kindness of Strangers. My wife suggested only With the Kindness of Strangers. Of course, with all due apologies to Tennessee Williams and Blanche DuBois in Streetcar Named Desire. The reason I wanted to call it Only With the Kindness of Strangers, because I wanted my sons, my friends, and my students to know about many good, kind, and generous individuals who help people every day, all over the world, partly out of sheer kindness, partly out of religious faith and obligation, partly out of ethnic pride, but mostly out of human solidarity. When at the age of 6.5 years old, I lost my mother, she was 26 when she died. For all practical purposes, my sister and I became orphans. In subsequent years, many individuals, mostly strangers from Iran, France, Lebanon, Brazil, and the U.S., took it upon themselves to help me survive, get an education, later to get a job, serve and succeed as an educator. Their support and solidarity had a major impact on me. It shaped my outlook on life and sustained my faith in humanity and the human condition. Throughout my life, I have been blessed by the benevolence extended to me by total strangers. Let me just cite a couple of examples. When I was 13.5 in Tabriz, Iran, a French vice consul who was of Armenian background, Edgar Maloyan, came to Tabriz. He told me, half jokingly maybe, half seriously, that I was a smart kid, I should go to Beirut, Le Petit Paris, and obtain my education there. I believed in him. And because I believed in him, he had to do something, I guess. So aged 14, 15, I was ready to go to Lebanon. I had no money except 3 letters. My father told me if I could get my passport, I could get it. I could go. Knowing fully well, no one at age 14 can get his passport. And that's a long story. I went and stood in front of the governor's mansion, got a signature from my priest saying that I was going to seminary in Beirut, Lebanon. Therefore, the Iranian government had no choice but to let me go to study religion. And after 6-7 months, I got my passport. But in order to do that, I needed somebody to pledge his deed of his house as a guarantee that I will come back. And there was an optometrist in Tabriz, Hrar Stepanyan, who pledged his house in order to allow me to get my passport. Edgar Maloyan gave me 3 letters. One letter was to Collège Armenian, Cemaran. Second letter was to Colonel Lahoud, head of internal security services of Lebanon. And the third one was Hotel Lux. So I said, my God, my future is state. So with $50, I flew into Beirut without Arabic, knowledge of Arabic, without knowledge of French, without knowledge of English. My Eastern Armenian dialect did not fit well with Western Armenian dialect. The amount of Russian I knew, Persian and Turkish, was useless in Beirut, Lebanon. And there, after 2-3 weeks, I found that I had to pay. Hotel Lux was not for free. And Collège Armenian, I still remember Shant, the distinguished scholar, writer, who was Germanic totally, with his monocle, with his goatee, impeccably dressed. He asked me 3 direct questions. Do you know French, my son? After I was introduced, a crane has come from Iran to our college. Do you know French? I said, no. Do you know English? I said, no. Do you Arabic? I said, no. Do you have any money? I said, no. What are you doing here? I said, I don't know. But Edgar Maloyan sent me. While I was ready to starve in Beirut, attempting to sell my blanket and everything I had, silver and so forth, Lola Sasuni, head of Armenian Relief Society, secured a restaurant for me, $6 a month for the food, twice a day, lunch and dinner, sliced so thinly you can see almost like the veil of the Salome, and 2-3 pieces of bread. And they found a small room, literally the size of this, with 2 beds. There was an Iraqi Armenian dentist living there and myself. I had to get up 3 o'clock to take a shower because family had 6 people in there. But the rent also was paid by Armenian Relief Society. Again, never met these people, but they took upon themselves. When I was in Beirut, I was given 1 year to learn French. I was told, if you learn, fine, you can stay. Otherwise, you have to go back. I couldn't go back because my stepmother had told me, I know you won't be able to make it, you'll return. Had she not told me that, I would have returned. I was taught French on the weekends by the copy editor of L'Orient, the son of Vahan Papazian. His name was Vache Papazian. all weekends, he took his entire time to teach me French. In the evenings, an urban planner, Vartgester Karapetyan, gave me additional instructions in between his bridge and poker games. I would go to the club. In the middle of the game, he will come and give me instruction and then correct. All of this for free. The presidents of the Armenian Red Cross of Lebanon and later Brazil, of all the places, São Paulo, Brazil, Red Cross of Armenian Red Cross, they sent me a tuition or scholarship, which for the first time allowed me room and board. They were hoping after I graduated from Chemaran, I would go to São Paulo, Brazil, and become high school director of the local Armenian high school. These three expatriate Armenian families, never met them, from Iran, Markaryans, Khanjians, and Mukhtarians, divided among themselves to invite me three times a week for dinner, saying, "You bring Mr. Voratsyan, my benefactor at Collège Arménien, whose eyesight is no good. Why don't you accompany him to our dinner, to our home for dinner, because he may fall." So they used me and used him, both of them, so I could go out three times a week free dinner at the Armenian home. At Christmas and other times, they would say, "We don't know your size. Would you mind, instead of gifts, we give you money, you can buy your clothes and so forth." What I'm trying to say, these are individuals I had never met, never heard of it. When I came to the States, 1956, August, I came with a letter to an Armenian, Zarifian, who was head of laundry division of Taft Hotel in New York. Took it to him. He took me to Long Island for 3-4 days to live with him in Long Island. Never met them. And then this generosity was not confined to Armenians or my principal, Mr. Voratsyan, without whose protection and making me his secretary, private secretary, and which allowed me room and board. I would never have been able to finish it. But once I came to America, Stanford became my second home. And that in itself is another story you'll read in the book, because my English teacher, sir, applied only to two universities, Stanford and Berkeley. Both of them accepted me. Stanford sent airmail. Berkeley sent surface mail, their admission. So that's how I ended up at Stanford. Again, all coincidences. Stanford became my second home. All my principal professors and other members of the community adopted me, nurtured me, encouraged me, inspired me, and prepared me for a teaching career. Even the story of how I traveled from East Coast to West Coast is a story of good-hearted stranger. Arriving at the airport in New York, Idlewild, I realized that I lost my airplane ticket, and I became desperate, since I was due at Stanford in 2 days. Of course, I also had no money to replace the ticket. Horrified, angry, full of self-pity, shame, and desolation, and with tears streaming down my cheek, I was at a loss what to do. Seeing my desperation, a ticket agent told me, "I have never done this in my life. I am about to do. I will stamp this empty envelope, marked New York to San Francisco, without a ticket in it. You can board the plane, but you must stay on board all the way. Do not disembark. Stay on until you reach San Francisco." Grateful yet fearful, I boarded the midnight plane. The 14-hour flight stopped in Chicago, Kansas City, Phoenix, Los Angeles, before arriving San Francisco. At each stop, I told the stewardess that I did not feel well and would rather stay aboard. The generosity of the airline clerk overwhelmed me, and I did not know even his name. Years later, I went to the airport, tried to locate him. I could not. But again, left a lasting impression on me, a man who helped another man in need as an act of solidarity. Education is another focus of my memoir. Indeed, this book is about teachers and books. Everybody was surprised that I have dedicated so much of the book to my teachers, because nobody writes about their teachers. They only write about one favorite teachers. I've taken upon myself to write about all my teachers. Editor and I had a big fight. She removed 50, 60 pages of all the professors. Let somebody else write about them. But I said they have affected my life. So I wrote about all my professors. who had great impact on me at Stanford, at Collège Arménien, and elsewhere. Collège Arménien itself was a unique institution. It was a high school, French lycée, Armenian school at the same time, populated by intellectuals who were thirsty of university teaching, but they could only have landed in a secondary school. Each of the professors educated in Moscow, St. Petersburg, Brussels, Charles University in Prague, all of them thought we were university students. Exact definition of feudalism had to be prepared by us, so not to make mistake. I learned more about art history, Hegel, and Schopenhauer, and Fichte, and Kant, and so are the high school students, because the professors were thinking they were in Berlin lecturing a university audience. And I have all the books, by great surprise of my wife. I've saved all my copybooks of high school, even some elementary school, and college notebooks of all these professors. So I'm very grateful to them. I especially remember Costan Zarian, the great writer who came from Italy, defining Ficino, that Ficino who was influential for Neoplatonism. So throughout years, I read Ficino inspired by Costan Zarian. Education, naturally, was instilled in me by my teachers. Reading became a necessity, an obsession for me. My teachers taught me that learning can be passionate enterprise, that it can be exciting, that great literature has inspirational, instructive, even redemptive qualities. When I was a little boy in Tabriz, Iran, I remember a great colorful and dynamic scene in front of the city police headquarters. There were many scribes sitting cross-legged in front of their makeshift portable desks, reading letters to illiterates, writing letters for them, as well as many official petitions on behalf of defendants, prisoners, and passport applicants. They wrote and read business documents. They were very busy. I don't know why, but I thought perhaps one day I would be a scribe, because my mother's maiden name was Mirzayan, coming from family of scribes. That I'll read and write letters for my illiterate grandmother. That did not happen. Instead, my teachers and mentors detected talents in me that I did not know I possessed. As a result, they gave me an opportunity and the means to transcend my limited environment in Tabriz, Iran. Thanks to them, I was put on a fast track, at first to Beirut, Lebanon, then to Stanford University in California, where I found my future, my authentic voice, my vocation, and a vocation as a teacher. Inspired by several of my teachers in elementary and middle schools of Iran, and later by those in high school in Beirut, Lebanon, at first I decided to be an elementary or high school teacher. At the time, I never imagined that I would be the first in my family to attend a university, especially a university in the United States. While my ambition was to be a teacher, I never imagined that one day I would be a professor and would teach in 6 different American universities. And I never dreamt that one day I would be the chief academic officer of an Ivy League university and chief executive officer of another one. Nor did I fantasize that one day I'll be the first foreign president of New York Public Library. These were all fantasies. This memoir is also about my Americanization. The first view of America I had, my sister and I, when my mother died when I was 6 and a half, and I was told, my sister and I were told, to say goodbye to her because she was going to America. We did not know that she died, and they did not want to hurt us, and therefore America became a fixation for me as a great place that beautiful people go. When I was a boy in Tabriz and a young man in Beirut, I had already been Americanized to a degree through Hollywood and its movies. My vision of America was one of fantasy along with some core values, quote-unquote, embedded in scores of cowboy movies, such as rugged individualism, justice, self-reliance, community action, fairness, and law and order for everyone. In Beirut, learning the English language gave me a better understanding of the content of American movies and their complexity. Reading Time magazine for the first time gave some of us a glimpse of a different, complex America. I ate my first hot dog and hamburger at Uncle Sam's Cafe in Beirut. headquarters for all the leftists and nationalists and revolutionaries who criticize America while sipping Coca-Cola, eating ham dog and hamburger. I had my first milkshakes, first Coca-Cola there. I was shocked to see American men and women wear blue jeans. How uncivilized, I thought. And men wearing colorful Hawaiian shirts. Terrible. The American University of Beirut and Beirut College for Women gave me a glimpse of America. Another thing that I fantasized about America was that all Americans wear eyeglasses. I thought they were reading so much. Such an educated nation, that's why they needed so many eyeglasses. The dream of going to America had been a fantasy. For me, America itself was a fantasy built and rebuilt in my mind and psyche. I lived it through scores of cowboy movies. My American heroes, who embodied courage, honor, loyalty, solidarity, integrity, self-sacrifice, patriotism, love of justice, and generosity, had prepared me for a fantasy land and sustained my dreams. None of the movies prepared me for my first encounter with New York. I was stunned, overwhelmed, intoxicated, blown away, as they say now. It was huge, massive, powerful. The varieties of sounds, colors, shades dazzled me. I had never seen or imagined so many cars, buses, ambulances, so many fire engines, police cars, taxis, and so many people in one city. The multitude, their energy, their fast pace were incredible. All of a sudden, I felt I was in the presence of a microcosm of all humanity, the whole world indeed. Every ethnic group, religion, race, continent was in New York. I had never seen so many tall buildings, nor had seen concentration of so much concrete, cement, and especially steel and iron. For the first time, I saw water towers and long fire escapes. They seemed to be everywhere. Elevators, escalators, and revolving doors impressed me and scared me, as did the number of shops and restaurants, not to mention multitude of well-dressed people. I got lost in Central Park. It was so huge that I thought it contained all the trees and all the gardens of Tabriz, Tehran, Beirut, Iran combined. The sight, however, of Central Post Office of New York City was a more welcome sight. On 8th Avenue and 34th Street, it was a civic monument, the post office, rather than a mere post office. It symbolized, as you know, stability, confidence, and durability. But what pleased me most, I read with great pride the words inscribed on the lofty entrance: neither snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. The quotation adopted from Greek historian Herodotus referred to couriers of the Persian Empire, where I was coming. I said, my God, at that time, 6th century BC, postal clerk could travel 1,600 miles in 1 week, and therefore we were progressive at one time. The Brooklyn Bridge, and I'll go on, but most important thing was that I felt for the first time as most unimportant being in New York. I sent home a note, said I felt like an ant, anonymous ant. If somebody stepped on me, they don't even have to bother cleaning it. So inconsequential. That's why when the TWA clerk helped me, I said, even in New York, the city of multitude, there's still solidarity. The opulence of Fifth Avenue, Madison, and Park did justice to my Hollywood vision of America. Broadway and Times Square stunned me. I had never thought it was possible for a city not to sleep or to have so much entertainment, so many bars, theaters, so many nightclubs, so much nudity, so many stations of sin and fantasy. But most impressive of all, I had never imagined seeing so much light and electricity in a single city. I felt as if the entire electric supply of the world was centered in New York, making it a city of light. This first-hand, fast-moving impressions made me imagine New York as the city of cities, the embodiment of power and of sheer energy. I wrote to my sister that New York was a gigantic magnet. It attracted everything and everyone in the world, every source of power, energy, and scrap of metal, and every creative idea. I had seen the Empire State Building in the movie King Kong, but nothing prepared me for the experience. I felt as if I were on the top of the world. After always observing the range and the depth of the city, its architectural and engineering wonder, I wrote home that in New York I felt, as I mentioned already, like an anonymous ant. If they stepped on me, I wrote, they would even not notice me. This city will humble anyone, I wrote, and teach everyone humility. I wrote adding that in New York, while you may be insignificant, at least you are at the same time just like anybody else, alone yet part of the multitude. San Francisco and Stanford University provide me the next phase of my Americanization. Here I'm not going to discuss much, because I discuss in my book about the dating system of Stanford University, which is in the genre of collection, historical data, as well as anthropological data over the time. But I will mention the fact that I saw my first commercial. It was Laurence Olivier's performance, I think Hamlet, if I'm not mistaken, when he comes forward, when the sword becomes a symbol of cross, suddenly interrupted, and a small animal ran on the screen. And they said, a burger is so much more refreshing. Drink a Burgermeister beer. We left 2-3 weeks later. We left in disgust, naturally. 2-3 weeks later, we're in a bar. And the bartender said, what would you like? Said, beer. What kind of beer? Said, burger. Realizing that for the first time, subliminal thing has been working, that burger is right to invest. Even if people dislike it, they still remember it. After all these years, they still remember it. While in California, I learned how to drink black coffee and eat Wonder Bread, which is lousy. I learned how to drive, how to date, how to go on a double date. I saw my first game of golf, first tournament of tennis, and first equestrian show. I saw my first horse race, dog race, and drag race. I learned about American sports, especially football and basketball. In San Francisco, I ate my first shrimp and lobster, and my first Mexican meal, including chili. I ate my first pizza, my first Chinese meal, drank my first martini, daiquiri, margarita, grasshopper, mimosa, and screwdriver. For the first time, I saw gambling in Lake Tahoe, Reno, and Las Vegas. I went horseback riding for the first time in Nevada and last time, where I was subject of a practical joke. My Stanford friends had bribed the stable owner, instead of giving me a horse, to give me a mule. While all of them were going, I was stuck. There was a happy audience laughing at me, at the joke. The audience included Elizabeth Taylor, Michael Todd, Debbie Reynolds, and Eddie Fisher, which I never forgave them for that. So when they got divorced, I said, it will teach you a lesson to laugh at me. At San Francisco, at Stanford, I bought my first, oh, by the way, I have to tell you, my first coffee adventure. I went to Zimburger and ordered black coffee, naturally. And then I said, do you have cream? I said, it's right in front of you. I had never seen cream in a plastic tube before, but they're all colors. I saw somebody pouring from the plastic in their coffee. So I took yellow one, unfortunately. It proved to be mustard. But I was so proud, like many immigrants are, as if I knew what I was doing. I like my coffee with mustard. After drinking a couple of sips, I was almost sick, so I used my newspaper as a facade to hide my disgust with that. At Stanford, I bought my first used car, got my first parking ticket, and my first traffic ticket. I was told in America you could bargain for nothing except used cars and houses. Other than that, it's gauche to bargain. So I went to my first shop to buy, to look at this jacket. I was surprised that for sale. In France, they say occasion, namely it's an occasion, opportunity. Sale, I said, sale. It's already selling, so why don't say sale? I not know what it meant. I was confused seeing on the streets. Some streets said pedexing, some did not. For months, I did not know what pedexing meant till I discovered pedestrian crossing. But I did not know why some are pedexing, some did not. But in San Francisco, I also saw got my first ticket. I threw it away, naturally. So how would they know where I am, who I am? When I came home one day, Mrs. Lake, my landlady, was crying. She said, have you raped somebody? No, I said, why? Have you stolen something? No, killed someone? No. She said, sheriff was here. So she showed me a paper, said, State of California versus Gregorian contempt of court. So I was very scared. So I was, my friends rehearsed me what I should tell to the judge. I appeared before the judge. Those of you who have been in traffic court, you know how fast it moves. On the day and on, guilty or not guilty. I said, Your Honor, that's why I'm here. What? I said, I'm here. You decide. Whatever you say is fine with me. So he knew he had a turkey on his head. You could see from his face, oh, Lord, why me? So then he said, my dear son, and when they say that, they mean you're not with it. My dear son, when you say you don't know, you mean you're not guilty. I said, I didn't say that, Your Honor. Policeman says, I'm guilty. I don't know. You decide. You hear? Fine. Then he said, in this country, you have to plead. I swear I never knew the meaning. I thought he wanted me to go on my knees. I said, never, Your Honor, never, never, Your Honor. He was amused, but not too amused, because he gave me a big ticket. I said, I cannot afford this, so you can pay with installments. Most importantly, what I found in America, at least at Stanford, was I learned that to work and pay for one's education was considered a virtue in America, a badge of honor. Even if one worked in the university's kitchen, cafeteria, dormitories, or physical plant, one would have died in Iran, in Beirut, in order to be a waiter or wash dishes, especially when known people come to visit that restaurant and say, my God, what has happened to Gregorian? Look at it. Where has he ended coming from all the way and so forth? My Americanization continued throughout my teaching and administrative careers in Texas, Pennsylvania, New York, and Rhode Island. I saw and dealt with a microcosm of America on our campuses and in my classrooms. From the very beginning, something was very clear to me. I had not come to U.S. as an immigrant. I had come to learn. I did not have an immigrant's clarity about America nor American dream. I was unlike others who felt in exile or deracinated. My teachers at Stanford taught me that in the U.S., the U.S. was a nation of immigrants that is a microcosm of humanity. It contained members of all ethnic, racial, and religious groups. They taught me that my Persian, Iranian, and Armenian heritages were assets, at least for a historian, rather than obstacles. While Armenians and Iranians have self-confessed weakness for nostalgia, I did not feel homesick. After my grandmother's death in 1964, the only tie I had with Tabriz was my sister, her family, some of my friends, and some of my childhood memories. That did not mean that I did not know Persian poetry by heart. That did not know that I did not love the great civilization of Iran. But my ties were now deeply sunk in America. The pace and the quality of my Americanization took new turn with my marriage to Claire. She became my best guide to America, the American family, society, its institutions, and mores. Since I did not have an idealized notion of what a family is or ought to be, I did not have a father or as a role model. Mr. and Mrs. Henry and Faye Russell, my in-laws, and their family became my extended surrogate family. Our three sons, Vahe, born in Beirut, Rafi, born in Redwood City, Dari Artashes, born in Austin, Texas, provide me another phase of my Americanization. I was exposed to sports, comic books, popular music, and teenage culture. At the urging of my wife, I took our children to doubleheader baseball. And I still have not understood all the intricacies of baseball. Basketball, I understand. Football, I understood. When they say shortstop Larry Boa, I say, where's the long stop? They go, oh, please, don't talk. You humiliate us. And that was wonderful because one of our sons ended up as a sports writer for St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Second became a military historian. He's now in the State Department, in charge of Kosovo and Bosnia desk. And third one covers all the New York courts, civil courts, all of them because I did not intrude in their lives. Everything they got interested, I showed interest, they lost interest in it. So therefore, anything they showed interest, I lost interest, they showed interest in it. So you can see how it works. Of all the freedoms America stood, I'd like to finish with that. For me, and still does, the freedom of speech, freedom of thought, and assembly and dissent, along with an individual's right to their privacy, which is protected by law, are luxuries in many, well, there are luxuries in many countries and many continents. I've always cherished and believed in them. Indeed, when I became a citizen of the United States in 1979, I invoke many of these ideals in a speech I delivered on my naturalization ceremony, which involved 77 other immigrants from 27 countries. Addressing peers at this momentous occasion, I said, "We America's new citizens are immigrants like our forefathers who founded this nation of nations. We come from dozens of countries, from many cultures, from many continents, many faiths, many colors, many languages, many accents, many races. We come from different social and economic backgrounds. We come from different political, we have different political persuasions. Whether we came to the United States for economic opportunity, political or religious asylum, education, security, or reunification with our families and relatives, we share a common fate in this country. We share James Madison's vision of a country built on diversity and idealistically guided by its motto, a pluribus unum, out of many one. This is a land where faiths, cultures, races, and ethnic groups coexist and contribute to America's democracy, as well as to its dynamism and creativity. We, the new citizens in the United States, like so many of our immigrant ancestors, have come not only to enjoy the benefits of America, but also to work for its development and welfare. We have come to lend a hand in reaching out for democracy's ideals. We know that the American dream is not only about making money, advancing in careers, or finding opportunity. In least, I told them, founding fathers did not create a land of opportunists, but the land of opportunity. We know that, above all, the American dream is about living in a land that has profound respect for human dignity, freedom, and for men's and women's potentialities. We have come to share America's legacy and mission and to contribute to that perfect union as envisaged by our Constitution. With its checks and balances, the Constitution has enabled us over time to abolish slavery, extend voting rights to women, expand the scope of civil rights and human rights, uphold equal opportunity and equity, broaden our right to free speech, strengthen the foundations of our legal and social justice system, and open our country's doors to immigrants. Finally, I said, we shared the vision of Walt Whitman, that democracy is the essence of American spirit and the purpose of America's existence. For Whitman's democracy aim was, is, and must be the perfection of human beings, a kind of training school for making first-class men and women who live lives of love and noble aspiration. Whitman wrote, "The United States themselves are essentially the greatest poem." Gabriel Garcia Marquez, in his novel Love in the Time of Cholera, speaks of the conviction that human beings are not born once and for all on the day that their mothers give birth to them, but that life obliges them over and over again to give birth to themselves. I agree with him. My life has been a strenuous, joyous journey marked by many rebirths and reinventions facilitated by opportunity and human generosity, especially made possible by generous people in my life, strangers, including one who's sitting there. Thank you very much.
Dr. Vartan Gregorian discussing his new autobiography, The Road to Home, My Life and Times. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 and includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog with help from John Perotti. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.
Tomorrow on The Connection, in the first hour, Fragile Ties. African-American leaders haven't always fragile ties. African-American leaders haven't always...